You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is television historian Kimberly Potts. Her new book is a comprehensive study of one of the most successful and well-loved television sitcoms. The book is called The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch, How the Canceled Sitcom Became the Beloved Pop Culture Icon We Are Still Talking About Today. Kimberly Potts, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's so great to get to talk to you about The Bunch.
Yes, I'm excited about it. I love the book. It's really fun.
Thank you so much.
What got you interested in writing a Brady Bunch history?
Well, I had been, I watched the show, I think I probably saw it a bit in syndication. I wasn't old enough to watch it when it originally aired, but I watched it in a little bit in at the end of probably the 70s, and then on the TBS airings and the TV Land airings, and, you know, it was everywhere. It's been everywhere since it began, really. But I was looking at some upcoming anniversaries a few years ago, upcoming TV anniversaries, and I noted that the Brady Bunch was going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary, and that kind of sent me down a little research, just, you know, looking at some things about the show. And as I was looking at it, I started just kind of making this little list of the many ways that it had continued, not just the spinoff series and the big screen movie, but just pretty much every area of pop culture you could think of, the show has continued on and has continued to make an impact in, you know, the Brady Kids recorded albums. And again, there were the spinoff shows, the variety show and the other sitcom spinoffs and the big screen movie. And of course, Barry Williams' great book, Marie McCormick's great book, Florence Henderson's great book, and all the work that they kept doing, that they kept appearing in all these other sitcoms, and that sitcoms like The Simpsons and Family Guy kind of lovingly spoofed them throughout the years in way more than a dozen episodes. They've just been there's a Weird Al Yankovic parody spoofing and honoring the Brady Bunch, because he was definitely a fan of the show. So there were just all these ways, and as I was compiling this little list became multi-page list, and I just realized this show that, you know, a lot of people kind of dismiss sometimes as being this frivolous, simple family sitcom, although other people, of course, to many, many people, it's just such a beloved show and such a beloved part of their childhood. This show really has had such an impact and continues to, its place in TV history and pop culture history. I just thought, you know, this is really deserving of a book-length examination of just how much of a place this show has in TV and pop culture history. And, you know, again, there was that great book by Barry Williams and the other cast members, but I think this was sort of a book, an examination that needed to be done by someone outside of the show. And so I really wanted to do the book and try to tie it to the 50th anniversary. And fortunately, my publisher agreed that it was you know, a deserving topic for a book.
Well, I think it is. I mean, you know, I was a little bit old for the Brady Bunch, and I didn't really watch it ever. And a friend of mine who's a few years younger than me was waxing nostalgic about it, and I said, you know, it's not a good show. And he said, you know, Gary, you have to take the nostalgia that's dished out to you.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so true.
Some truth to that. But, you know, I'm sure that the people who were in the show, Florence Henderson and Robert Reed and the kids, you know, they all thought when the show went off the air that that was it, just as William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy thought when Star Trek went off the air that that was it. But those roles became the roles for which they will be remembered forever.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a great comparison between those two, because they also, Star Trek and the Brady Bunch, are shows that really lived on because of syndication. They were the first two really big shows that lived on in that way and then became the spinoffs and the big screen movies and all of those things. And I think the other thing that those two shows have in common is that their cast members all had very complicated relationships to their shows, in that they, you know, at times have hated that they continue to be defined by those roles. But then I think they've had, you know, periods, and I would hope all of them at currently kind of have a, and I know that William Shatner goes back and forth with that, sometimes not loving being Captain Kirk still, but, you know, I think for the most part, they all seem to be at a place where they can really appreciate the fact that 50 years later for, and a little more for Star Trek, that people still love those shows and those characters and their performances so much. And that was another thing that I think is most remarkable about the Brady Bunch, is that, you know, those kids were very young when they did the show. It was only a part of their lives at that point for 5 years, and now 50 years later, you know, people, there was that great HGTV series documenting that they renovated the original house to look like it looked on the show, and the cast members were involved, and I think they really got a chance to understand now how much people love them and appreciate their performances when they were just, you know, little kids.
Well, so the show was created by Sherwood Schwartz, I learned in your book, and he was also the creator of Gilligan's Island. And there was, I think the thing that those two shows have in common is the theme song. That was really a key to selling the story.
Definitely. It's got that story, the theme songs that tell the whole story so that you don't have to go over that every week. That was a big concern for the networks when he was pitching both shows, and that was a big part of him being able to sell them on it, that he wouldn't have to explain the premise over and over again, because obviously, especially with Gilligan, it was very high concept. And, you know, definitely the Brady Bunch, you need to sort of understand the basic premise. But and the theme songs, both so iconic, both of them among, I think, the most iconic TV theme songs ever. And I've heard people say that they know, for instance, the Brady Bunch theme song, even if they've never seen an episode of the show.
And it's been used, you know, so many people have satirized it and used that format of those little boxes.
Absolutely, yeah. Another iconic aspect of the show is definitely that opening sequence with the tic-tac-toe board. I always think of it. It's been spoofed and cleverly used many, many times.
And that was actually difficult to achieve in 1969?
Exactly. That wasn't something that was just readily a technology that was readily available. It was something that they really helped put out there and put out into the entertainment world.
So how did Sherwood Schwartz come up with the idea of the Brady Bunch?
It's actually a great story. He was reading a newspaper one morning, the Los Angeles Times, and reading it over breakfast, and he saw this little item that said, you talked about how there was, and I always am forgetting the percentage now, but it was, I should remember this, but there was a big percentage of families that were blended families, and it was a percentage that was very high, much higher than he would have imagined, and I think that most people would have imagined, especially for 1967 when he read the original item. And so he thought that should be, he felt very strongly that people should always find themselves represented on TV. And so he thought that was an idea that would make a great sitcom, how these blended families, you know, what was different about them, what their lives were like as they tried to merge these, you know, differing personalities and family members and backgrounds together. So he right away, he also thought if he had that idea after reading the item that other people who read that item would immediately have the same idea. So he went that day to the Writers Guild to register his idea. And that's how the bunch was born.
Well, that's interesting that you can register an idea. How did he write up a page long summary or what?
He did. He wrote a little treatment for his idea and took it and registered it at the Writers Guild.
And that turned out to be a lucky thing, because I always thought that the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball was at least part of the inspiration, but that's not true.
No, not true at all. In fact, but it did help him because he a lot of interest from all three at the time, only three networks. and he had interest from
That's
all
the way
of them.
It was in those days.
Exactly. So much less TV at the time. And so he had interest in it. They were all interested right away, but they all had a little issue with it, something they wanted him to change. And he was very, at that point, he had had success with Gilligan, so he didn't feel like he needed to bend his idea to meet what they wanted. And so he stood firm, and it just didn't happen at that point. Then, of course, the success a couple of years later, the success of Yours, Mine, and Ours happened. And all of a sudden, the networks all called him again and said, yeah, we're interested in this. And he was able to get them to agree, ABC, to agree to do it exactly as he wanted to do it. And in fact, there was a little postscript to that. The writer of Yours, Mine, and Ours contacted the network, ABC, and was kind of hinting that he thought that the Brady Bunch might have been stolen from him. And Sherwood was able to, prove that he had gone to the Writers Guild to register this idea well before that. So he kind of had the last laugh there.
That's fascinating. And Kimberly Potts, the look of the Brady Bunch was very unique. I mean, there was a kind of a period in the 1970s, a rather nauseating period, I have to say, in which... You know, people were wearing really big neckties that were broadly colored, and the color palette of that era is captured. You know, the Have a Nice Day era is captured so brilliantly in the color palette of the Brady Bunch. And how did that come about?
They wanted, again, very much to appeal to the younger audience. And Sherwood was one of the things that he felt most strongly about with the show, and that he most steadfastly stood his ground. He wanted the children to be the focus of the show, not the parents, and that was something that was very different. And he also wanted, and the reason behind that was because he wanted the show to appeal, first of all, to children. He wanted them to see themselves. He wanted them to see their lives, the kind of issues they faced growing up. He wanted them to see that on screen. He wanted it to be a show that they would watch and that then their parents would watch with them, even if it may have seemed a little, juvenile or too young for them, for the parents. He thought that if he created a show that so strongly appealed to their kids, that their kids cared so much about, they would watch it as a family, and that did turn out to be true. But a big part of that was the way that the kids dressed. I always think of the wide collars and almost all of them wore striped pants several times throughout the series. But, and as you said, those colors, those vivid colors that were just such a cheery but very dated, you definitely do not associate those colors and those clothes with any other time period. That was again a real big part of what he did, one of the many things he did to make sure the show would appeal to that audience.
Now, Sherwood Schwartz had, in addition to Gilligan's Island, he had had, a pedigree in television and in radio as well, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. He had worked on a lot of shows in the 50s and 60s. After he was in the Army during the war and had worked on entertainment products during that time as well. His older brothers were writers in Hollywood and had kind of gotten him started as a writer for Bob Hope on his Pepsodent radio show. And so it kept snowballing for him. Once he started that career, he had wanted to be a doctor originally. And once he dipped his toe into Hollywood, though, thanks to his brothers really getting him his start, he never looked back. He, obviously he had some very, very big successes. Among the most beloved TV shows in TV history. And so that worked out for him. And although for his whole life he did always have regrets that he hadn't been able to become a doctor.
Yeah, he couldn't become a doctor because of anti-Semitism. Is that right?
That is right. I mean, that I think that's still, you know, that's heartbreaking to read. He really is someone who wanted to do it for the right reason. You know, he didn't want to become a doctor because he wanted to become wealthy or any of those things. He really felt very strongly that he was meant to become a doctor and help. He wanted to find a cure for diseases. He wanted to treat diabetes, things that he saw were going to become, you know, even bigger issues than they were at the time. And he just really wanted to devote himself to that. But because of anti-Semitism in medical schools, he just couldn't get in.
So he made us all happy instead with...
He did. I think he contributed a lot to the world, and I think that's something that he was proud of and acknowledged, certainly. But his daughter told me that he kept a medical bag in his office for the rest of his life. That was still something that he, you know, had really cared about and really wanted to do.
And he lived a long life, I believe.
He did, into his 90s. So he, you know, I think that it's probably a little that his family is a little wistful about the fact that he didn't get to see the current you know, outpouring of support and love for the show that happened on the 50th anniversary and with the HGTV project. But I think he certainly got to see the many, many kind of rebirths of the show with the spinoffs and with new generations finding the show in syndication and the big screen movie and all of those things that happened after the original series. He certainly had a chance to understand how much the show was loved, and I think he understood its place in TV history as well.
I think the Brady Bunch had a longer run than Gilligan's Island in its original.
It did by two seasons, yeah. Mm. And as you and I had talked about a little earlier, the show ended kind of prematurely in terms of when they thought it would end, so they did originally think it would go longer than 5 seasons.
Yeah, there never was like a farewell episode, but they didn't do that as much then as they do now, but there was never a goodbye Brady Bunch.
Right, and I guess which was ended up being appropriate since it never really went away. But that final episode is, I mean, it was Greg graduating from high school, which I guess is a good, you know, it's a good marker, a good milestone, but he did it without his father there, so that's a little bittersweet.
This is Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Kimberly Potts. She's the author of The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch, How the Canceled Sitcom Became the Beloved Pop Culture Icon We're Still Talking About Today. And I wanted to ask Kimberly Potts about the cast of the Brady Bunch, beginning with Robert Reed. Yeah, Robert Reed had played, you know, pretty serious roles on television before the Brady Bunch. I remember him well in The Defenders, where he was the son of E.G. Marshall, and they were father and son lawyers who dealt with controversial topics in a very realistic, well-acted CBS drama. So how did he get in? How did he get? I'm sure he wasn't happy being in the Brady Bunch, and how did he get in there?
He wasn't happy about it ever, and made that well known throughout the series and after, in the many years after, even though he continued to do the spinoff series, and he was not happy about it. He got into it through a development deal. You know, he was signed to a deal with the network, and they didn't really have another place for him. And he wanted to get paid, so he agreed to do the Brady Bunch. He, I think he thought at the beginning that it was going to be maybe a little more serious than it was, but that was his big objection to it. He, as you said, he had done The Defenders, which was a really great, well-respected show, well-written, well-acted, way ahead of its time in a lot of the topics that, as you said, controversial, cutting-edge kind of topics that it covered at that time, and that was what that was his first big TV show, so his first starring role on TV, and so that was kind of his expectation of what TV should be. And then he went to the Brady Bunch, where it was, you know, focused on the kids and their problems and the things that they dealt with, he wasn't very happy with it. He let that be known to Sherwood Schwartz and his son Lloyd, who was a producer and director and writer on the show, and in very unkind ways a lot of the time. He had a lot of anger about the show. He was very close to his castmates and especially was very fatherly in real life towards the children, so he kind of kept that from them. But at other times, when the kids weren't on the set, he, you know, could be very vocal about how unhappy he was. He wrote a lot of memos to network executives and to Sherwood Schwartz about, you know, detailing in minute detail the things that he was unhappy about. He didn't think it was realistic. He thought it was too fluffy. He wasn't at all happy. He was also a Shakespearean trained actor. So again, he just thought that he should be playing much more serious roles, what he considered to be more substantial roles, and it just wasn't something that he ever kind of got over and accepted. He continued to do it, and again, treated the children very well, was close to his cast, you know, had good relationships with his adult castmates as well, but never really came to appreciate and love the show, even though, again, he kept doing the spinoff series, including that crazy over-the-top variety show that the cast did for one very short season in the mid-70s.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's terrible. But before we get to that, what about Florence Henderson? I mean, Florence Henderson was known for her musical talent. She had been cast by Rodgers and Hammerstein in The Last Road Company of Oklahoma. I think that's where she got her first big break. She had a beautiful singing voice and was perfect for that kind of stuff. And I know I saw her on TV on the Sunday Night Bell telephone hour where she sang. And it seemed like the Brady Bunch was not a good fit for her.
You know, they wanted her originally, and then she kind of thought the same thing, that it really wasn't what she wanted to be doing. So she kind of passed and went on to do a movie that wasn't a big hit, and that kind of changed her mind about pursuing the big screen as the focus of her career. And by that time, they had already cast Joyce Bulifant, who I think a lot of us will remember from the Mary Tyler Moore Show and some other
lots of game shows.
Exactly, a lot of game shows. Just a very bubbly, great lady. I think she was always fun to watch. They had already cast her as Carol. They had cast her and put her through wardrobe, and she had gone on this crazy diet because they wanted her to lose a few pounds for being on the show before they started filming. So she was very involved at that point. And then all of a sudden, Florence Henderson became available again and let that be known. And once it wasn't just Sherwood Schwartz, because he certainly felt very loyal to Joyce Bulifant since she had, you know, been cast and was in the midst of wardrobe fittings and all of those things. He was certainly very sensitive to that, but the network kind of intervened and said, no, if we can get Florence Henderson, we want Florence Henderson. And so they met with her and talked to her, and she agreed that she wanted to do the show, and so they had to break the news to Joyce Bulifant that, you know, they were going to go in a different direction, and so they hired Florence Henderson. At that point, Ann B. Davis was not involved. Because Joyce Bulifant was known much more as a comedic actress, and so they had hired Monty Margetz, who was an actress who had started out doing a cooking show where she admitted that she didn't know how to cook, and that was kind of her appeal. You know, she would ask the audience to help her and call in and write in with tips for her, and so that was a very interesting concept. And then she became an actress, and she was in a lot of sitcoms. So she was Alice at that time. So it was Joyce Bulifant who they thought would provide a lot more of the comedy, and Monty Margetz as Alice would be sort of much more of a straight woman at that point. But when they hired Florence Henderson to replace Joyce Bulifant, she wasn't known as much for comedy, and so they thought they needed to replace Monty Margetz And Sherwood Schwartz had always been a fan of Ann B. Davis as Schultzy, of course, from the Bob Cummings show. So she was kind of, they switched the focus for Alice to be kind of the funnier, goofier, physical comedy, you know, provide a lot of that for the show, and Florence Henderson would be much more the straight woman as Carol. Although I think she proved herself to be a very talented comedic actress, and I think in her music shows and her music performances, she was a very funny lady, and certainly that's something that all of her castmates said about her, that she had a great sense of humor, a kind of body sense of humor, which we maybe wouldn't have think at all from her performance as Carol, but you know, that kind of changed the focus of the show, and I think everybody would agree that it worked out well, especially since it brought Ann B. Davis into all of our lives.
Well, I loved Ann B. Davis when she was Schultzy on Love That Bob, the Bob Cummings show, which is from a previous generation, and I watched that one when it was in syndication. It used to be on like every afternoon. Love That Bob. And I loved Ann B. Davis. She was hilarious.
She really was a great lady, and again, I think most people agree the show would not be the same without Alice, and I think she is always at the top of people's list of the things that they most love about the Brady Bunch.
All right, so the show, after the show's life, I want to talk to you about some of the better episodes, but before we talk about that, after the show went off the air, we were just mentioning that there was a couple of sequels. The show didn't disappear entirely. And one of those was this horrible variety show. And you showed me a clip of them doing a Wizard of Oz thing. It was just, like, terrible. How could such a horrible show ever get on the air? And why would they want to do it, even though maybe people love it? I don't think there's a clan of people who love that show, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think it's sort of one of those little things that maybe not even every Brady Bunch fan knows about and are very surprised to hear about. And then there are the people who sort of know about it but maybe never actually saw it, because it's not something that's been, you know, rerun a lot. It's not. It was available, I think, on DVD for a while but is now out of print, so it's very difficult to find a copy. We're kind of left just with the clips on YouTube or various places that you could find clips, and they're a treat, though. I mean, it's surreal is really the best word to describe it. The way that it came about was that the show had gone off the air, and you know, ABC had canceled it, but then it started in syndication right away, and the numbers for the syndication viewings were very, very big, and the show was clearly still popular. That was a shock to ABC, and so right away they were trying to think of a way that they could bring the show back. And the idea that they came up with, and by the way, they did this without Sherwood Schwartz or his son Lloyd Schwartz's involvement at all, which you know was
well. That
not
would account for a lot of it, then.
It absolutely does. They didn't involve them in it at all. In fact, they have both said that they found out about it when they saw the announcement, the advertisement for it in TV Guide. And so, you know, that was a big shock. But ABC wanted to get the show back on the air in some way, and so they made a deal with the Croft brothers, who Sid and Marty Croft, who we know from a lot of very over-the-top children shows.
The Banana Splits.
The Banana Splits, and also at the time, variety shows were big with Donnie and Marie, and several of the Brady cast members had guest starred on the Donnie and Marie show. So ABC decided they wanted the Bradys back. They loved variety shows, so they combined the two with the Crofts, and we got the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, which is just the clip that you were talking about is on YouTube. It is the Brady Bunch cast members dressed as Wizard of Oz characters with Rip Taylor as well.
What a great Sam, what a great personality he was.
Oh, I loved Rip Taylor. So they're dressed as Wizard of Oz characters performing what's it called, Rolls Royce? Royce, I think that was the band's name.
Oh, right.
The song Car Wash, which we all know.
How appropriate.
And yes, right. I mean, just so many mashups are such a thing now, but that was really a mashup that just the minds that, you know, that come up with that, you have to just, again, there's no word to describe it but surreal. And that's how the whole show was. It was the cast singing popular songs, so contemporary songs, with crazy over-the-top costumes. In one, Robert Reed was dressed as Carmen Miranda with, you know, the fruit basket on top of his head, everything. I mean, it was just, and this, there was a concept, though. The concept was that the kids decided they wanted to get into showbiz. The Brady kids decided they wanted to get into showbiz, so they convinced Mike to sell their house and move to Malibu into a beach house while they became the stars of this show. So, I mean, even
right.
That,
so they are in character. All of the actors, yes, are in character as the Brady Bunch performing,
yes,
on this terrible variety show.
On this terrible show, which is, though, admittedly very fun to watch. And the reason they all did it, you know, they wanted, their careers were not going great at that point. They were being typecast as the Brady Bunch, the kids especially. And it was good network money, and they had always enjoyed working together. So they all signed up for it, even though not everyone, you know, Florence Henderson obviously was very comfortable with the singing and dancing. Some of the kids were as well. Others, Robert Reed wasn't particularly comfortable with it, but he liked doing things outside his comfort zone, so he signed on, and again, money. They all wanted the network paycheck, and he wanted to be, you know, he would never necessarily admit it, but he liked being around those people, and he wanted to be back with his castmates. Christopher Knight, in particular, didn't feel comfortable with his singing and dancing abilities, but you know, he wanted to be back with his castmates and a part of the show as well, so he signed on. So, you know, they liked being together. They liked performing together. They liked making a TV show together, even if it was this crazy, 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 crazy variety show.
In the first episode, the kids get together and talk to Mom to say they want to throw Dad out of the act because he's terrible.
Yes. After he had sold the house and moved them to Malibu, yes, they were willing to kick him out of the group. Fortunately, he stuck around for the craziness, which included Ann B. Davis in several episodes. In fact, she was in that infamous car wash episode playing the Wicked Witch, and Rip Taylor, and some big name. I mean, they had some big name guest stars as well. Tony Randall, I'm forgetting a lot of, but they had some very big names coming onto the show to perform with them. And, you know, the whole variety show genre of the 70s was crazy anyway. And you would find people, one of the great episodes included a guest appearance by Farrah Fawcett and Lee Majors when she was Farrah Fawcett Majors when they were married. And she was Charlie's Angels and he was the $6 million man. And they ended up at the Brady House for an episode. So just some really high-concept, crazy, over-the-top things.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking tonight with Kimberly Potts. Her new book is called The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch, How the Canceled Sitcom Became the Beloved Pop Culture Icon We're Still Talking About Today. Well, Kimberly Potts, tell us about some of the original episodes. What are some of the standout Brady Bunch episodes? I've missed them. So which one should I, if I wanted to watch, you know, some of the classic ones, which ones are they?
Well, I think certainly Amateur Night in season 4. That's my go-to favorite. It's the one most people will think of it as the Silver Platters episode, where the kids buy their parents an anniversary gift, which costs more than they expected it would. And so they have to come up with, I forget the amount, like 50-some, they have to come up with more than $50 quickly. So they decide to go on this talent show where they could possibly win money, and they come up with some costumes for themselves. I mean, they're many kind of, you know, typical Brady aspects of this show. They, you know, overnight come up with these elaborate matching costumes for themselves. They sing these songs that they apparently have written, their original songs. They choreograph them. They put all of this together overnight and sneak off to record this TV show that their parents know nothing about. But it is one of the kind of most iconic episodes, because we see them sing and dance together, and those became things that most Brady fans, especially those who have watched the show even once, those are the things that they can, you know, sing the whole song back to you, the songs that they performed. So that's, for me, I think, probably my favorite show, my favorite episode, and one that I think about most often when I think about the Brady Bunch. There's, of course, the Marsha situation with Jan, because she's so jealous of her sister. So that's one to watch. Any Jan episode is a big one. There's the infamous football episode where Marsha gets hit in the nose with a football that her brother throws, and that gives her a swollen nose and ruins her big date with the big man on campus. She is very upset about that, and the famous quote is, "My nose, my nose, my nose."
How did they write dialogue like that?
You know, how do they? How did they get away with writing dialogue like that? Again, now as an adult, you see kind of the charm of that, I think, and I think that's a big reason the show has continued to be so popular and is so beloved and such an important part of kind of people's childhoods, and just the nostalgia aspect of you know, how much people love the show, is that they remember those things, those quotes, and those kind of silly situations that seemed very real and very important, and that they identified with very much at the time. You know, they're silly in hindsight, but you remember how much you love them as a child.
Well, on Star Trek, in the second season, they added Chekhov, who had kind of a Beatle haircut, and that was because... That was because the show was on opposite the Monkees on another network. So I wonder if the episode where they suddenly start singing and dancing, did that have something to do with the Partridge Family's success?
It absolutely did. The Brady kids very much wanted to have music be a bigger part of their show, because the Partridge Family, I mean, it hasn't endured nearly as much as the Brady Bunch has all these years later, but at the time, it was a network brother to the show, but the ratings were quite more impactful than the Brady Bunch ratings were. And the actors thought that was very much because of singing and dancing on the Partridge Family, and so they wanted to incorporate a lot more of that. Sherwood Schwartz didn't want to as much. He didn't object to them singing on the show. He just didn't want that to become the focal point of it, because that wasn't the show that he had, you know, intended. That wasn't the show that he wanted the Brady Bunch to be. And there was a bit of headbutting over that before the final season of the show. So there, it wasn't a total sad situation for the kids when the show ended, because, you know, they thought they wanted to go do other things. They were still a little upset that they hadn't been able to convince Sherwood to incorporate more singing and dancing into the show. But, you know, that wasn't, in the end, again, all these years later, it isn't the Partridge Family that gets the kind of love and attention and house renovating that the Brady Bunch does. So, big picture, I think they won out in the end, and pretty much everything that Sherwood Schwartz stuck to his guns about, he ended up being right about.
Now, Kimberly Potts, in addition to writing this wonderful book, you host a podcast, or a couple of podcasts. Tell us a little bit about where we can find you.
My co-host and I, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, who is an entertainment author as well, she wrote the best-selling book, Seinfeldia, and has also written books about the Mary Tyler Moore Show and Sex and the City. We host a pop culture podcast called Pop Literacy, and another about kind of the business of being an author called Hashtag Authoring. And you can find both of those at writersbone.com or popliteracy.com and authoringpod.com.
This book is called The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch, How the Canceled Sitcom Became the Beloved Pop Culture Icon We Are Still Talking About Today. And we were talking about it today with the author, Kimberly Potts. Kimberly, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. This was so fun.
Oh, that was Kimberly Potts, author of The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch. We turn now to artist, painter, printmaker, educator, Robin Smith. In addition to being an artist, she's also the creator of a global event called Print Day in May, which is coming right up. Robin, tell us, what is Print Day in May?
Print Day in May is 24 hours each year. It's the first Saturday in May, where printmakers all over the world make prints, have parties, hang out, make more prints, and then post them on our website and our social media sites and share them with the world.
What's the name of the website?
It's www.printdayinmay.com.
And so this year, can Print Day in May happen?
Well, actually, this year, Print Day in May in some ways is more relevant and important than ever because it's really a community-building event. It's the kind of thing where starting at 1 minute after 12 on the first Saturday in May, basically in the South Pacific, people begin printing, and they keep printing all day, and it travels across the world for 24 hours and ends up back in the South Pacific. But in the meantime, tens of thousands of printmakers all over the world are all doing what they love on the same day. So it's kind of instant community, which is exactly what we need right now, what people are craving.
And you actually have people from all over the world participating?
Yeah. Last year we had over 60 countries. We had printmakers from over 60 countries. This year we've just added, Brunei we just added, and Israel had not participated before. So we're adding countries every day. I'm getting 10 or 20 registrants on our website every day. But then, of course, we have people that aren't registering. We have people that are just doing this and posting on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And we have a Facebook group. So Print Day in May, Print Day in May, Print Day in May.
How long have you been doing this Print Day in May thing?
It's been going on about, since 2007, but it started with about 10 people in Monterey, just all kind of printing on their own in their studios, but calling each other on the phone and saying, hey, this is what I just printed. And then it started to grow after that. So as I said, we have tens of thousands of people that do it every year. And we have sponsors as well. So we have art supply stores, printmaking equipment. We have residency programs. We have a hashtag campaign, so people post their social media images from the day, and they hashtag them with the names of these companies and PDIM to 2020, whatever it is. Each company has its own hashtag, and that's advertised earlier. And so, at the end of the event, the sponsors pick their winners, and they give gift certificates, and they give residencies and art classes and all of that kind of thing.
So this first Saturday in May, there'll be no Kentucky Derby, but there will be Print Day in May.
That's right. May 2nd, you cannot watch the horses run, but you can watch the art being made.
And if they visit printdayinmay.com, there's more information there.
There's all the information you need there. You can also, as I said, visit us on Facebook, Print Day in May, Instagram, Print Day in May. And we have a Print Day in May group where people can just post on their own as well.
Artist Robin Smith, and you can find her work at robinsmith.com.
Indeed.
Thanks so much for dropping by, Robin.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.